This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. I'm thrilled to have in the studio with me today Vandana Shivam, the great environmentalist and feminist and global justice activist. She got her PhD in physics, and she founded the Research Foundation for Science, Technology, and Ecology back in 1982. She's the winner of the Right Livelihood Award and the Earth Day International Award of the United Nations, and she's written about 30 books, if you can believe that, including Biopiracy, Earth Democracy, and Soil Not Oil. Vandana Shiva, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Hello, Pat.
Listen, how did you get interested in environmental issues?
Well, I think I was born into an environmental concern because my father used to be a forest conservator posted in the Himalaya, and my mother, who had become a refugee as a result of the creation of Pakistan, and was a very senior educational officer in the government before the country split, opted to become a farmer. So I would spend my time either in forests or on her farm. And it was basically, you know, I couldn't imagine life without either the land or the forest. But it's the 70s, mid-70s, that really made me consciously committed, because I'd gone back to my favorite places before leaving for Canada to do my PhD. I just wanted to swim in my favorite river, walk my favorite forest. Forest wasn't there, the river wasn't there.
What had happened to them?
They'd been cut down to make apple orchards, and the apple orchard had destroyed the oak forests, which were the source of water. And the apple orchards themselves failed because the climate was so badly damaged that it was no more right to grow apple either. Because of this absolute shock of losing these favorite rivers, I was just chatting around, and the villagers started to talk about how a new movement had started. And it was given the name Chipko because women of my region were saying, you'll have to cut us up before you cut the trees, because we're going to hug the trees. And to hug means Chipko in our language.
Now, was that activism by women unusual?
I don't think it is. I think it's assumed it should be unusual. But if you really look at the history of contemporary ecological movements and responses, Bhopal, who's holding that movement of the worst industrial disaster together, is the women of Bhopal. Who shut Coca-Cola down in Plachimada in Kerala? The women of Plachimada. So no matter where you look, it's the women who hang out and stick out their necks. Because of the division of labor, you know, they were the ones who were told the important things you do, looking after children, getting the food, the getting the water, even though it was devalued in the market. And so the value of losing living resources, of water disappearing, of forests disappearing, of soil desertifying, of seeds disappearing, it ends up being something women respond to much more strongly, because the men were pulled out of sustenance. I mean, I define the economy as really three layers, the basic being ecology, nature's economy, the second being sustenance, where we as human beings take care of what we need for sustenance, our food, our water, our healthcare, our learning, etc. And then there's the market. And in the market, this craziness of derivatives, etc., that is a creation of the last two decades, is a short-lived balloon that already burst in September. But the economy goes on with people's efforts and nature's gifts. And because men were pulled out historically to work in plantations, to work in mines, to go off and work in factories like GM, they're the ones who were most removed from the sustenance issues. So as long as they had the job fixing a car for General Motors, it didn't matter if the aquifers were going dry. And of course, again, because in the third world, livelihoods are so much more intimately connected to what nature gives us, that intimacy is much more. Whereas in the industrial world, you've got been separated by so many layers of distancing, which lets people imagine they're free of nature. They're only removed from nature, not free of nature.
And so you joined up with this movement then in the
1970s. I joined up with CHIPCO, became a volunteer, and religiously did my physics, which was a passion, and I still have nostalgia for it. But every holiday, I was with the women of CHIPCO, twice a year, and would do the work that I could do. The women had never gone to school. They didn't know how to read and write. They knew everything about the forest. So they became my teachers of forestry and ecology, and I became their scribe, just writing the reports, translating their local language and Hindi into English, into graphs. And it's amazing how the moment you put something into a graph, it suddenly has more meaning and more weight than all the experience of the people of the world. And I've had a debate in WTO once when a very famous economist said, "Oh, what you're telling us about is anecdotes." I said, "It's very strange how one economist making assumptions creates facts, and billions of people living their lives are mere anecdotes."
I'm speaking with Vandana Shiva, the great environmentalist, ecologist, feminist, global justice activist out of India, who's done so much for the global justice movement. Has this movement of women tree huggers, as they'd be called derogatorily here in the United States, been successful?
Yes, very successful, though not instantly. It's not Nescafe coffee. It took from 72 to 81, but in 1981, logging in the high mountain regions of my area in the Himalaya was banned. It was the first ecological victory. And the interesting thing was women were giving us ecological lessons even before the 1972 environmental conference in Stockholm, which was the beginning of a series of environmental conferences. And they're the ones who made a shift from the idea that the forests were merely mines of timber to the recognition that they were the source of water, they were the source of soil, and they were the source of clean air. And this is now in the climate negotiations. It's in watershed management strategies, etc. But it was the lived knowledge of coexistence with forest ecosystems and the fact that their lives depended on these forest systems for food, for fodder, for water, that when the forest went, the water went, and women had to walk longer miles. And I believe the women's walk for water in the third world is the most important indicator. Things like GNP and GDP are totally misleading figures. In India, we have 9% growth and 25% of our people without food. That can't be growth. If food isn't growing, if people's hunger isn't being removed, then you're measuring a very fictitious transaction that works for some people. We do have 4 of the top 10 billionaires of the world today are Indians. But their wealth, of course, is not coming without a relationship to the destruction of our ecosystems or the denial of fundamental needs of our people.
The destruction of the ecosystems is one of the prime reasons, and I guess at the ground floor, the walk for water, the longer and longer walks for water is one of the reasons for the global warming conferences. What was your reaction to Copenhagen?
Well, I had a dual reaction to Copenhagen because I already knew what the script was going to be. After all, President Obama had announced during his trip in September to Southeast Asia that there was not going to be a legally binding treaty, there'd only be a political declaration. He went with that agenda. And I think the Chinese are being blamed unnecessarily because the Chinese were never supposed to have been part of the international legally binding reduction of emissions. It was the rich countries which were part of the Kyoto protocol system, and the U.S. had never signed it. President Obama went very, very clearly to destroy the international legally binding treaty. And he put in its place this thing called the Copenhagen Accord, which most people haven't signed into. And then, of course, the dominant media is so much available that it converted the whole thing as being a destruction caused by the Chinese. The Chinese were mute witnesses. They weren't players in this disruption of the international agreement. But I knew this is how it would be because I was watching what he was saying before he went to Copenhagen. So I spent most of my time in the citizens' movement, amazing conference called Climate Forum, amazing energy of the people, hundreds of thousands of people listening intently to 4-hour sessions, the top scientific discussions taking place, as well as political agendas. And if you were in Climate Forum, you came away hopeful that people have the energy. If you were stuck in Bella Center and you watched the fizzling out of the whole process, you could go into total despair and need to take Prozac. Thank goodness, you know, I wasn't putting my hope out there. But something beautiful has emerged out of that failure. The president of Bolivia is calling a meeting on climate change and the rights of Mother Earth. And I think that is amazing. That what we need a shift. We've had a few decades of thinking that corporations are the primary citizens of this world. Only corporations have rights. Copenhagen was destroyed to protect corporate rights, the rights of the oil industry, the rights of the automobile industry. Citizens' rights have been destroyed, but most importantly, Earth's rights have been ignored. And I think Bolivia putting the rights of Mother Earth as the organizing principle for the future of humanity for this century, I think is the kind of shift that we seriously need. Definitely in my own land, 95% people would subscribe to the fact that we can only be good human beings, and all human beings' needs can only be met if we protect the rights of Mother Earth. And I believe a large number of the younger generation, even in the United States, would say, yes, the rights of Mother Earth have to be considered. We cannot just have constitutions and WTOs based on the rights of corporations. So I think we are undergoing a tectonic shift, and to the extent that the possibilities are open that we can organize life differently, including politics and economics. I think it's, for me, a very, very hopeful time. It's a time of despair, but also a time of hope.
How do you define the rights of Mother Earth, Earth rights?
I think first and foremost, the rights of Mother Earth mean the recognition that we depend on her. She's the mother who provides. And secondly, that she has a right to continue to be able to provide. And on the basis of that, we have human rights. If we defend the right of Mother Earth to her water systems, we will have water. If we defend her rights to her soil and her biodiversity, we will have food. If we defend her rights to maintain a carbon cycle, we will not have climate havoc. So all human concerns ultimately are predicated on the rights of Mother Earth.
Vandiana Shiva is my guest today. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine. Vandiana Shiva, a lot of your work has been against genetically modified organisms, GMOs. How is that going?
Well, in India, Monsanto entered in 1998 illegally because they never took permission from the appropriate authorities of the Environment Protection Act to do the trials that they had started. And I sued Monsanto at that time. Their commercial approvals were delayed. But in the areas where Monsanto has established a monopoly on GM cotton seeds, those are the areas where we have a totally new phenomena unknown to India, farmer suicides. 84% farm suicides are taking place in the cotton belt, which is now predominantly Monsanto's BT cotton. When Monsanto tried to launch a BT eggplant called the BT Brinjal in India, there was outrage. The environment minister was forced to hold public hearings. I think it's the first time genetic engineering has been subjected to that kind of public hearing, except for Switzerland, which has had a referendum and has banned GMOs. The parliament has just extended the 5-year ban to another 5-year ban. The BT Brinjal ban was forced on the government by the public. 7 cities' public hearings were held. The industry, of course, doesn't let go because Monsanto has seen trillions of dollars of profits in royalty payments. Genetic engineering brings no advantages. There's only herbicide-tolerant and Bt toxin crops, neither benefit to the environment nor benefit to people. It does bring patents to Monsanto. Patents bring royalties. And seeing these royalties, Monsanto would like every seed and every crop to be genetically modified and patented. So, of course, they've started this huge assault, both on the ban in India as well as the ban in Europe. And in India, they're trying to float a new law. We have a law that controls GMOs. They're trying to float a new law called the Biotechnology Regulatory Authority Act, which makes questioning the safety of GMOs, which every reasonable, rational human being should question, a jailable offense, 6 months jail and 200,000 rupee fine. The government would have to jail a lot of people. It is also taking away from the regions their ability to decide agriculture policy under the Indian Constitution. Agriculture is not a federal subject. It's a state subject. So what we're seeing really in the GMO issue is an attempt to establish a dictatorship over our food system and our seed system. Not just in India. This dictatorship has already been established in the United States. Most farmers don't have any choice anymore. They have to buy GMOs. And therefore, you have an antitrust case. The monopoly of Monsanto has gotten so big that even the DuPonts of the world are having to challenge that monopoly. And I think we need to think very deeply about reclaiming our seed sovereignty and reestablishing food democracy. It's probably the most important economic and political challenge facing any society anywhere in the world today.
Well, how do you do that, Vandana Shiva? How do you reestablish food democracy?
Well, I've tried to do it through establishing Navdanya, which means the nine seeds, to have seeds in people's hands. We create community seed banks. We've set up 55 across the country. Seeds that are not genetically modified, seeds that are not patented, seeds that are part of our commons, can be shared, can be saved. And I think this movement is there in terms of heritage seeds in the United States. But I think everyone should have the right to have a garden with their own seeds. Every farmer should have a right to have seeds that are not genetically modified and not patented. In terms of food democracy, I think this amazing gardening movement that has emerged all over is an example of food democracy. The fact that young people are saying we will not have canteens running on junk food. We care for our health, we care for our future. That food issues have become campus issues everywhere. These are all steps of setting up food democracy. It has to be one meal at a time, one family at a time, one school at a time, one seed at a time. But the point is, there are enough people, there's enough meals eaten, that if we make a commitment that we will not be forced into junk food and toxic food, and that dictatorship is not acceptable to us. And for me, it's very strange. You know, Boston Tea Party was about a time when the United States, like India, was controlled by the British Empire. And I hear there's something called a Tea Party mobilization, but they never talk about the control of food by agribusiness. They want freedom, but not from the corporations. They want freedom from public security. They want freedom from living in the commons. And that cannot be freedom for a human species that needs the commons to survive.
Yeah, they have no sense of what the commons is, the modern-day so-called Tea Party people. But you certainly do, Vandana Shiva, and you've been talking about food democracy, and you talk a lot about democracy, not in the formal sense, but you talk about deepening democracy or having a living democracy. You made the choice, rhetorically, obviously, to claim this term and expand this term. Why is that your choice?
The two reasons why I opted for earth democracy, a deepening of democracy, first, because I witnessed how country after country, people wanted one thing, their governments did the other. And governments were supposed to have represented the people. It was supposed to have been by the people, of the people, for the people. And yet representative democracy was becoming by the corporations, of the corporations, for the corporations. We've seen that in every negotiation of the World Trade Organization. We've seen it on issues of Iraq, in Afghanistan, where billions of people, Martians, said, we don't want to go to war. And the governments went ahead and sent their troops to war. But the second reason is, in my country, most of the people still live on the land. 10% live in the forests. They are the tribals, the indigenous people. The rest are small peasants, average holdings of less than 2 acres. Now, everywhere in the country, tribals are peasants and peasants are being driven off the land because this global economy, with its limitless appetite, must predate on the last mineral, on the last drop of water, on the last inch of land. And this predatory global corporate capitalism is becoming such a threat to the very survival of our people. Our people are fighting back. The tribals are fighting back and saying, we will not give our land for aluminium bauxite mining. The farmers are fighting back and saying, we will not give our land for special economic zones and automobile factories. This, in my view, is democracy. And we need to find a way to make the democracy of the 90% the real democracy. And in this democracy, people belong to the earth, are off the earth. That's why I've called it earth democracy. But I've also called it earth democracy because it begins from the ground up. Anything living grows from the bottom up. Everything dangerous, like bombs, get dropped from the sky down.
I'm speaking with Vandana Shiva, the great environmentalist and ecologist and feminist and global justice activist based in India. You talked about predatory corporate capitalism. The assumption, the ideological assumption behind it, other than, you know, what is private is good, is that there's a limitless amount of resources and that we can have unending growth and maybe a technological fix for any problems that might come up. What's wrong with those assumptions?
Well, the assumption of unending growth, it's false materially because resources have limits. Non-renewable resources on the basis of which the entire fossil fuel civilization is based have clear non-renewable limits, including the peaking of oil. But even renewable resources have limits. You mine too much water to do industrial farming, you're going to have no water. That's what's happened to India, where the Green Revolution was introduced. Beyond a point, if you use renewable resources beyond their renewability, you're going to have no water, you're going to have no rivers. But it's also up against the limit of fictions. After all, the collapse of Wall Street in 2008, September, showed that you cannot keep cooking up instruments to make money out of money out of money out of money. Beyond a point, this will burst as a bubble. And it has happened. And I've just picked up Joe Stiglitz's book at the Chicago airport on the free fall of the global economy. Now, he's a Nobel laureate, except the difference is he sticks to what he knows to be the way affairs run in society. And he knows that you cannot have an idea of limitless growth and unregulated markets. Unregulated markets are not self-correcting. Unregulated markets give you the havoc that the world is living through. And instead of saying we will bail ourselves out, they're now getting the government they wanted to disappear to bail them out. The technological fix question. Industrial agriculture gave us the mess of desertified soils, waters that had been destroyed, biodiversity destroyed, and hunger and obesity as the two gifts of a system of producing food that doesn't produce food. The technological fix for that is genetic engineering. Makes everything worse because it means everything about maintains all of industrial agriculture, high water use, high energy use, low biodiversity, energy inefficiency, bad production, non-food produced as food, except that now you add toxics into the plant so that every cell is producing a Bt toxin. Every cell is producing herbicide resistance. It just makes the situation worse. Technologies are embedded. Technologies are introduced into society and ecological systems. Therefore, when they go wrong, you have to look at all the aspects of what they damage. You can't just take a bad technology, multiply it twofold, and think it'll be correct. Just as you can't take collateral debt obligations, square them, cube them, and somehow assume that the mess will be cleared up. squaring and doubling errors does not clean up the error. It just squares and triples them.
I'm speaking with Vandana Shiva. You're listening to Progressive Radio. With corporate globalization has come a rise in fundamentalism around the world. I wonder if you see a causal connection between that. And I also, we have about 3 minutes left. I wanted you to explain, in an interview you had said you've had to suffer the violence and brutality that comes with rising fundamentalism. And I wonder if you could elaborate on that.
I do believe there's a causal connection between the rise of fundamentalism and intolerance and corporate globalization. Any system that appropriates the resources of others, any system that must destroy people's freedoms and democratic rights, will give rise to ways of expression that are extremist. I wrote a book called The Violence of the Green Revolution when I found that in the region where the Green Revolution was introduced, the new violence was taking place, 30,000 people were killed in Punjab. That's six times 9/11. And when I studied in deep intimacy, I realized that the violence of Punjab was intimately linked to the model of a non-sustainable farming system imposed from the outside, turning food and agriculture into a commodity. We've seen that happen everywhere in the world. We've seen that happen in the Middle East, as the Middle East was turned into a war zone to control the oil. That is where the most extreme forms of violence have emerged. In India, we have new violence emerge as the tribal land is appropriated. The tribals are forced to arm themselves to defend themselves against the armies of the state supporting the corporations for the mineral access. And this is the map of the world. If we were to make a map of the world, we would find a one-to-one correlation between resource grab, destruction of democracy, and the emergence of extremist violence. And what extremist violence does is it sadly divides society precisely at the time where people need to stand together. Because then people start to get divided along religion, along gender, along region, around ethnicity. Diversity is our strength, but fundamentalism ends up mutating diversity into a problem where everyone is afraid of everyone else. And politicians play on this. In fact, if you look at it, elections are now fought more on a divide and rule policy than people together for a common good.
And were you yourself a victim? How were you a victim of this?
Well, I'm a victim of it through my mother, first and foremost, because my mother was a refugee of a divided India. When Pakistan was created, people forget that Pakistan was born precisely out of this kind of mentality. And I am a victim of it in terms of seeing every day my society get divided along these new lines. My son is in Mumbai. And now we have a new political party saying no outsider. Now, other Indians are being called outsiders in Mumbai. We have to watch every word you speak, because under fundamentalism, things can be distorted. I think fundamentalism and globalization are two sides of the same coin. They both have to be addressed together. And the way I would like to address them is through re-embedding ourselves in our common humanity as citizens of a common earth.
Vandana Shiva, thanks so much for that. We need a new coin. It's been a pleasure meeting you and talking with you.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.